I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, a conversation about foster care and parents who take in children with the hope of adopting them. More than 120,000 kids nationwide are awaiting adoption, but even though most adoptions in the U.S. take place through the foster care system, most foster children are eventually reunified with their families. The United States is the rare exception in allowing foster parents to even consider adopting the children they care for. And what about race and class? Does a black child raised by white parents risk losing her racial identity? Reporter Yvonne Wenger wrote a series in the Baltimore Sun late last year about her and her husband's experience as foster parents and their quest to adopt a child. She joins me, along with Joan Jacobson. She and her husband adopted two babies more than 20 years ago. Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for hanging with us this afternoon. Today, it's a conversation about foster parenting and adoption. In the United States, there are about 443,000 children in the foster care system. 4,000 of them are here in Maryland. Most are reunified with their families after spending time in foster homes, but more than 120,000 children are waiting to be adopted. That's the highest number in nearly 10 years. The long waiting list is a result of a number of factors, including a decline in international adoptions and the opioid crisis. Foster parenting presents unique challenges for those who want to be foster parents to children that they hope to adopt. There is always the chance that even after a child is brought into a home and a bond of love is established, that circumstances will change and the child will be placed with a biological parent or a relative who can make a legal claim to care for that child. Yvonne Wenger is a reporter for the Baltimore Sun. She and her husband, Artie, are the adoptive parents of a toddler named Adeline, who came into their home originally as a foster child. Yvonne shared her family's experience of foster parenting and adoption in a wonderful and affecting series for the Baltimore Sun that was published in December. It's called The Wait. Yvonne Wenger joins me here in Studio A. It's good to see you.
Oh, thanks, Tom. I love your show.
Well, you're very kind to say so and very kind to spend time with us today. And listeners, we are streaming our conversation on Facebook Live, the WYPR Facebook page, so you're welcome to check us out there. A little later in the program, we will take your calls and emails. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can always tweet us as well, @midday WYPR. So tell us about Adeline.
She's perfect.
Of course.
She's perfect. She is such an easy baby. I Googled the other night. I was like, why are some babies so easy? She just, you know, we put her down at night. We try to stick to like a really rigid schedule and put her down. And, you know, if she's not ready to sleep, we can hear her singing and playing in her crib. And she just wakes up and she's filled with joy. And she's a dream come true. She loves to dance. Yeah, she's perfect.
And you got her when she was how old?
2 days old.
2 days old. Mm. And she was, when she came into your home, she was a foster child.
Yes.
So you had in the back of your mind, the front of your mind, thinking maybe this baby can stay with us forever and ever. I mean, Explain where your head was at when Adeline was delivered to your house in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
About 16 months ago.
So we were celebrating my girlfriend's birthday at the Blueberg Cocktail Lounge in Hamden. And I... After being a foster mother to two boys for about, at that point, about a year and a half, their mother was calling to say goodnight to the little one and her son, and I had missed the call. And so I put my phone on the table because I wanted, when she called again, to tell her that I was out and I was sorry she couldn't talk to him. And she would call from different phone numbers because she was in kind of unstable living conditions. And so a phone number popped up and I didn't recognize it, but I picked it up thinking it was going to be the boy's mother. And it was a worker from DSS. And she said...
The Department of Social Services.
Department of Social Services. And she said, there is a newborn baby girl who is about to be discharged from the hospital. And her mother wants to sign her rights away but there's a young man who is believed to be the father, and he wants to raise her. Would you want to take the placement? And I said yes, knowing that there was a chance to adopt, but there was a very likely chance that she would be leaving us. And when I think back on that moment, how special it was, I can't even describe to you the way I feel inside. It was 8:27 on September 27th, and it was the best moment of my entire life. So my friends come around, and they're paying the bill, and we're leaving, and we're running to Target before it closed at Mondawmin, and buying a bunch of supplies for a baby girl. And then, you know, hours pass, and I thought maybe it was all a misunderstanding and that she wasn't actually going to come. But at 1:30 a.m., a car pulled out front, and a worker double parked on the street, and I ran outside to the sidewalk, and she hands me this baby that many months later would officially become my daughter. Just incredible.
And this journey started many years prior to that. You and your husband, Artie Nordstrom, tried to have a baby. You started trying to have a baby in your late 20s, yeah. Right? How old are you now?
I just turned 39.
Mm-hmm. So over these last 10 years, all yeah. of this has come down. You tried to have a baby, and then that didn't work out. Mm-hmm. And you had some options to think about. What were the options when it came to, you wanted a family? You write so beautifully in this piece, The Weight, in the paper oh. about you know, the kind of family you grew up in, and the kids running around all over the time, and you have a lot of friends, particularly girlfriends who are having babies, yeah. you know. So how did you come to the conclusion or the decision to enter the foster program as a route to adoption?
I think there was a lot of guideposts in my life that led me to become a foster parent, starting when I was a little girl in Catholic school. And I remember learning for the first time that there was such a thing as foster care and foster kids. And I was just struck by the contrast with my life, which was, you know, raised in a home with both my parents and my little brother, just a really loving and stable home. And so always I thought about foster care. And when my husband and I decided to try to have a baby when I was 29, we tried on and off until I was 35 and was ready to confront why I wasn't getting pregnant. And I went through a series of tests, which were pretty awful for anybody who's been through infertility. Testing is pretty pretty unpleasant. And as we were getting information on why we weren't getting pregnant, I just thought that there are all of these children who are waiting. And we considered private domestic adoption or international adoption, both of which could take years and cost a lot of money. And I remember thinking to this spare bedroom that we had across the hall from our own bedroom, and I thought, why do I want to let that bedroom stay empty for all of these years while we're waiting, when it could be filled with a child or two who need a warm and safe place to go temporarily and maybe permanently?
When you enter the and as I said at the top of the show, most kids in the United States who are adopted are in fact adopted through the foster program.
Yeah.
This is a normal thing for kids who are adopted. But of the kids in the foster system, 62% of them are eventually reunified with their families. So the emotional difficulty of understanding that, you know, you're helping this kid out for however long she may need it. You're obviously going to form a bond with this child who's living in your house. And you have in the back of your mind, maybe I can adopt this child. Mm-hmm. And you started with two foster children, two brothers. And you got one time, and then a little while later, you got the other. So the two brothers were reunified, but they were reunified in your house. always thinking, you know, maybe these will be our children. Mm-hmm. And that's always in the back of your mind. How did you handle that? How did you process that? And what's your advice to those people who are going through that very thing now, who are foster parents, thinking that, you know, maybe this will also turn into an adoption situation and not just a foster situation?
So in some foster care communities, social media, or even some of the networking events that are available, people who have infertility especially, or people who go into fostering with an intention to adopt, is a controversial thing, even though most of the kids in the U.S. who are adopted through foster care, and there's 123,437 kids who are waiting for adoption. A lot of people don't think that if you go in with an intention to adopt, that you can serve the real purpose of fostering, which is to support the reunification. And I can't say that when my husband and I set out to do this, that I fully understood what that would look like, and definitely what it would feel like. But we wanted to do something really good with our life. And we had the ability to do it. And I thought that we had some time to make a different decision if at any point it felt like we weren't going to be able to build our family through foster care adoption, then we had some other options that we could pursue. And so getting your heart broken as a foster parent in a lot of ways is kind of the whole point, because you want to be the person that helps the child heal. And so with our younger foster son, he came to us at 15 months old, and he went home after his third birthday. So he was with us for more than half of his life. And when I think about how much it hurt when he was no longer living with us, I can quickly remind myself of the brain development that happened for him in the 15 months that he was with us, and the way our love and support and stability will affect him for the rest of his life, and likewise for his older brother, who was 9 when he came to us. And so, yeah, it's it hurts like hell to say goodbye, but if you can understand the greater good that you're doing, then I was able to get through it.
You write about these two kids, these two boys. They have both been reunified with their father, right? And together, right? So they themselves are together, and they're both in their dad's house. And you're still in touch with that family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all the time. We just had the boys for a weekend recently. We took them to the pet expo at the fairgrounds, and the little guy got to ride a horse. And then, you know, I took their father to a social service office recently to try to help him get some stuff straightened out. So, we're in regular touch.
So, having gone through that experience, having brought them into your home, having developed a beautiful bond with them, and then having to give them up, that was the context in which this new baby came to you, Adeline. So you knew at that point, you had, before you adopted or fostered the two boys, it was maybe an abstract concept about what it might mean if they were, you know, reunified with their family. It was no longer abstract when this little baby came, Adeline. You even took a while to name her, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so how was it different then when Adeline came into your home, as opposed to when the other two boys came into your home? I mean, you had some pool of experience at that point.
I was reaffirmed in my commitment to be a foster parent, and so was my husband. It felt good to see the way we knew we were making a difference. And because of Adeline's circumstances with her mother wanting to waive her rights immediately.
Yeah, she told you this right after this baby was born. She was at a place in her life where she didn't think she could care for the child.
Yeah. And so what she did was invoke something called the Safe Haven Law, which first popped up in Texas in the late 90s. And it allows people to, mothers and fathers, to relinquish their children in safe places like hospitals or fire stations to avoid the, you know, just horrible situation of people abandoning babies in dangerous places. And anyway, so this mother was young and had a lot of goals, and she wanted to place the baby for adoption if the young man who she named as a possible father didn't want to care for her. So anyway, there was some things that made us more hopeful about the potential to adopt this baby, who we would name Adeline, from the beginning. It was a different sort of case than it was for the boys when they came to us.
Yvonne Wenger is a reporter for the Baltimore Sun. She's a foster mother and an adoptive mother of a beautiful toddler named Adeline. We'll have more with Yvonne Wenger when we come back after a quick break. We'll also talk with former Sun reporter Joan Jacobson. Joan and her husband, Bill Berry, are white, as are Yvonne and her husband, Artie. The children that they are fostering and adopting are African American. We'll talk about that dimension as well. When Midday returns, we're talking about fostering and adopting here on Midday. 410-662-8780. If you'd like to join our conversation with Yvonne Wenger and Joan Jacobson, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. You can also find us on the WYPR Facebook page where we are streaming our conversation. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Thanks, Nathan. I'm Tom Hall. You are, in fact, listening to Midday, and we are very grateful for that. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, we chronicle the history of state-sanctioned racial apartheid in the United States by taking a close look at one of the Supreme Court's most impactful and notorious decisions. Washington Post associate editor and the author Steve Luxenberg talks about his latest book, Separate: The Story of Plessy v. Ferguson and America's Journey from Slavery to Segregation. It's a terrific book. Looking forward to a conversation with Steve Luxenberg tomorrow about the history of Plessy v. Ferguson. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about foster care and adoption. Yvonne Wenger is a reporter for the Baltimore Sun and the foster mother and adoptive mother of a toddler named Adeline. Yvonne shared her experiences of foster parenting and adoption in a series for the Sun called The Wait. Joan Jacobson joins us now as well. She's a former Baltimore Sun reporter who is the adoptive mother of two young African-American men. Joan and her husband, the labor historian Bill Berry, are white. Their children are African-American. Joan, good to see you.
Thanks for having me here.
And listeners, if you'd like to join our conversation, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. To follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR. And you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Joan, full disclosure, you and my wife, Linnell, are very, very dear friends.
So yes.
Very longstanding. And she and I were around, actually in the house, when your two children were
right.
brought to you.
Right.
Willie and Alex, who we've known since they were babies. You went through a private adoption agency.
Yes.
This was 25 years ago.
Right, 26 years ago.
Things,
right.
You know, perhaps have changed a little bit, but tell us about that decision at that time and why you decided to do that.
Well, at the time, The Department of Social Services the Association of Black Social Workers believed that white families should not adopt black children. And so since we lived in Baltimore City, any black infant would not be available for adoption to us. So we went to a private agency, and we made it clear that we were certainly willing to take a child of color, but we did want a newborn. So that's what we did.
And was the fact that you weren't, say, waiting for a white child to become available, was that going to speed up the process?
Oh, yes.
In terms of the available children for adoption?
Yeah. There was, I think, quite a divide between prospective adoptive white families who only wanted a white child or a not white newborn, and those of us who didn't care about the race. And the people who wanted to adopt white children waited a long time and also spent a lot of money. They went to agencies that charged tens of thousands of dollars.
And Yvonne Wenger in the foster system, and Joan and Bill did not go the foster route. They went through the private agency. But in the foster system, is there any discussion about the race of the children that may or may not be placed with you?
So I think it was in 1994 that the federal government passed a law saying that race couldn't be a factor in placing a child. And so we were asked, my husband and I were asked about what demographics we were looking to foster, if there were limitations, and we had none, although we were looking to foster children who were younger than 5. Although I will say the median age for kids available for adoption is 8, and there is a tremendous need for foster and adoptive parents for older kids.
And Joan Jacobson, Willie is now 26 years old.
Yes.
His brother Alex is 24.
Correct.
Willie came to you first.
Right.
How old were both the kids when you
Willie was 3 weeks old. Alex was 5 weeks old. And the reason why he was 5 weeks old is because at the time there were some ridiculous roadblocks in adoption. And if the child or infant you wanted to adopt came from another state, there had to be something called an interstate compact, which means Alex was born in Virginia. We were in Maryland. Some bureaucrat in Virginia had to sign off on his adoption, and a bureaucrat in Maryland had to also sign off. And the person in Virginia, for some reason, was difficult, and so it took longer. So he was in a private foster home during the weeks when we were waiting to adopt him, and we actually went to visit him in Northern Virginia before we could bring him home. But they were still infants, both of them.
But at the time, your decision did not include fostering a child.
That's correct.
You wanted to go straight to
right.
adoption.
Correct.
Yeah. And there are open adoptions and closed adoptions.
Correct.
What kind of adoptions are these two kids?
They were both closed.
So what does that mean?
What that meant at that time is that we had no contact with the birth parents. But we were given information. We were given documents about questions the birth mothers answered in the hospital of whether they took drugs or smoked. And, of course, it's self-reported, so you don't know what is accurate. Also gave us information of biological siblings that the mothers had already in their care or in foster home. And so the names of those children were whited out. In Alex's, actually in both of their cases, in Alex's case especially, but of course I took a knife and scraped them off so I could see.
Because you are, after all, a reporter.
Because I am a reporter and I'm used to doing that. And so I've always known their names and actually recently Alex had his DNA tested and was immediately in touch with a biological sister. And so he was able to say to her, "So your siblings' names are XXX," and she said, "How did you know?" And he said, "Is your grandmother's name such and such?" And she said, "How do you know?" It's from the adoption records. So
Alex is 24 years old.
Yes.
What was that experience like for him to be connected to his sister?
Well, I think he's thrilled. I think it's a lot to process. He has a lot of biological siblings. But of course, with social media, immediately photos were sent, and he looks just like them, and so he's in contact with them, and I think it was a bit overwhelming, but I think thrilling for him to connect with them.
And Yvonne Wenger, you got baby Adeline when she was just days old. Was this when you eventually were able to adopt her? Is this an open or a closed adoption? And did you have any choice in the matter? Who decides that?
It's an open adoption at the mother's request, and I had always wanted an open adoption for a child because I feel like in our case, there's a lot of family that's very close geographically to us, and I think that that can only enhance Adeline's life.
Have you thought about when, I mean, Adeline is 16 months old, so have you thought about when you'll have a conversation with her? This is a thing that adoptive parents, you know, have to confront and think about all the time. Have a conversation with her about her origins and how she came to you and how you became the family that you are?
Yeah, I want her to never remember the first conversation. I want it to always be an ongoing narrative. I have a book now that I read to her. Certainly, I wouldn't expect that she could comprehend that at the moment, but I want her to think about, and I've read it in from other families built by adoption, is that I have a side of my family. My husband has a side of his family, and Adeline has a side of her family. I want it to be part of who she is and what she understands about herself always from the beginning.
And Joan Jacobson, your two boys, when did you start talking about their situation?
Well, at the time, it was already known that if you started telling your child a very simple adoption story around age two, very simple, like when you were born, you had another mommy and another daddy, but they couldn't take care of you. We became your new parents. Happiest day of our life. You tell them that simple story maybe 100 times, maybe more, between the ages of two and three. They will, by the time they're three, understand what adoption means, that they're adopted. Mm-hmm. And we did that, and it worked very well. And in Alex's case, because he has very dark skin, we then began adding a story, and you got your beautiful black skin from your birth parents. So so he understood why his skin color is different from ours.
And the conversations about race that you've had with these two kids, you know, have evolved and have been a real central fundament to your relationship and the way you all function as a family.
Sure. I mean, we live in Baltimore City. We live in a very integrated city, and they went to city public schools, which are more black than white. And so I remember one of them was studying the Jim Crow era, and what better way to explain what it meant would be to say, well, when the Jim Crow era was in Baltimore, we couldn't be a family. Mm-hmm. So those are the kind of conversations we've had. It's very natural.
And Yvonne Wenger, as a mother, as a foster parent, as a reporter, what do you make of the fact that the United States sort of stands alone or almost alone in countries that allow foster parents to even consider adopting the children? Most other countries, according to Richard Barth, who's the dean of the School of Social Work at the University of Maryland, and he has a podcast associated with your written story in The Sun, talked about, you know, the fact that the United States is an outlier when it comes to saying foster parents can consider adopting the children. A lot of other countries say that's not a bad idea, or that is a bad idea. The whole point of fostering is to be a temporary haven, safe haven for children, and is never meant to be a full-time enterprise.
I think that when you have a foster home that can transition into an adoptive home when a child's situation changes, that's a good thing for the kid to have continuity and one less disruption in their life. But I do think it goes back to the training that the foster parents receive, the training that Baltimore City's Department of Social Services offers. was very clear that the point of foster care is reunification. And as long as you can go into it understanding what your role is, then I think it's in the child's best interest to be able to remain in a home that had been foster and becomes adoptive.
And Joan Jacobson, when it comes to the issue of race writ large, let me ask you to put your reporter hat on here. It is a fact that children of color are disproportionately represented in the foster system as opposed to white kids. So how does that impact the general zeitgeist, the general notion and thought of publicly held common wisdom now about biracial adoptions, transracial families?
Well, I think it's becoming more welcoming than maybe it was 25 years ago, that you have children who need homes. And in a place like Baltimore City, there are people of so many different races and family combinations that it's more acceptable now.
You wrote an op-ed that appeared around the same time that Yvonne's series was running. About an experience that one of the kids, I can't remember who, had at school, and they were like 4 or 5 years old,
yeah.
And a little girl was very taken with Alex, I guess it was. Tell us that story.
Well, the teacher, the kindergarten teacher, said to the little girl, "Why do you like Alex so much?" And she said, "Well, because Alex's parents are white and I have two daddies." Mm-hmm.
So even at age five, this kid understood the commonalities.
It's incredible, and that's the atmosphere that you want your kids to grow up in. In Baltimore City, for example, the public schools teach you so much about, say, Black history. I remember once when we were driving home from school one day in elementary school, and Willie had a little children's history quiz book. And said, "Alex, name three presidents of the United States." And Alex was in first or second grade, and he said, "Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, and Harriet Tubman." And I said, "Alex, Harriet Tubman was never president, and I got to tell you, there's never been a woman president, and there's never been a Black president." And he said, "What?" It was incredulous. So
yeah.
You want your kids to grow up in that kind of atmosphere.
Yvonne Wenger, before we take a break, do you get looks, when you have Adeline in the stroller and you're walking down the street, or you walk into the grocery store, or playtime or something? I mean, how have those experiences unraveled, and what's been your reaction?
Oh my goodness, Tom, that's a loaded question. There's so many different interactions that we get, and I think it all comes down to the fact that I look very different than my daughter. I'm really fair. My daughter has beautiful dark skin, and it's immediately obvious to whoever comes across us that our family is built through adoption. And so we've had, experiences all across the map. People who have said ugly things to me, women, African-American women who are teaching me the ways that I should describe to Adeline the beauty of her skin. So lots of reactions.
Yvonne Wenger is a reporter with the Baltimore Sun who wrote a wonderful series called The Wait about her experience with her husband, Artie Nordstrom, in the adoption and foster care system. Joan Jacobson is a former reporter for the Sun who adopted with her husband, Bill Berry, a couple of kids more than 25 years ago. We'll have more with Yvonne and Joan when we return after a quick break. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. We are also on the WIPR Facebook page if you'd like to ping us there. By the way, in conjunction with the series, The Wait, Yvonne Wenger lists a couple of ways that you can help. One way is to make a donation to the Baltimore Child Abuse Center. They collect things like backpacks and duffel bags and diapers and car seats. And we've got a link to more information about that on our website, wypr.org/midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you just joined us, we're speaking with two adoptive mothers about their experiences as foster care parents, foster parents, and adoptive parents. According to the Department of Health and Human Services, 63% of children adopted from foster care go to white families. White families also make up 71% of the total number of adoptive parents in the United States. Transracial or interracial adoptions now account for more than 40% of adoptions in America. So how has the conversation around interracial adoption changed over the years, and what are some of the rewards and challenges for parents who are raising children of different race than themselves? My guests today are two white mothers of African-American children. Yvonne Wenger is a reporter for the Baltimore Sun. She and her husband, Artie Nordstrom, are foster parents and the adoptive parents of a little girl. Yvonne's series in the Sun is called The Wait. It ran last December. It's accompanied by a terrific podcast. Joan Jacobson is here with us in Studio A as well. She's a former reporter for the Baltimore Sun. She is the mother of two sons, who she and her husband adopted as babies. They are now in their 20s. To join our conversation about adoption and foster care, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to send us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR, and to catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. You go to that page and you'll see that we are streaming our conversation. Let's go to the phones to Kenny in Baltimore. Kenny, welcome to Midday with Yvonne Wenger and Joan Jacobson.
Yeah, good afternoon. How are you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm blessed.
Me too.
Yeah, my question is very simple. Majority of foster parents that want children between the age of 0 and 5, their interest is to adopt. But down the line, you discover that the children are reunified with their biological family. How do the foster parents cope with separation or removal of these kids from their own? Are there resources out there to assist them so that they will not be discouraged to accept another children in their home, another child in their home?
Yeah, thanks for the call, Kenny. So, Yvonne Wenger, are there resources for parents like you who had two children that you were fostering for a while? I mean, this was a few years we're talking about. It's not like you had these kids for 6 weeks. But every 6 weeks, you would hear from the Department of Social Services with an update, you know, yeah, you keep them. Oh, no, we're going to go to court. Maybe. So you're living with this constant, you know, it hovers over the whole enterprise from day one. Once you have to go through that traumatic experience of giving the children up, which is, as you say, the whole point of fostering, are there resources that DSS makes available or anybody else?
There's a number of support groups that are operating right here in Baltimore City and presumably across the state. Catholic Charities runs one, and the Department of Social Services had one for parents who were ready and waiting to adopt. And then, of course, there's lots of support online through specialized groups for foster and adoptive parents.
And in terms of transracial adoptions, Joan, have you and Bill had experience with any other, you know, are there support groups or are there people who offer particular counseling and particular advice?
You know, I don't know if there is now. When we adopt our children, there were groups made up of parents. We had for a few years, there was a group of adoptive parents, and most of those children were of different races, but it was more of a social get-together. So I don't really know if what there is now. I'm sure that now that the internet is, you know, full-fledged, when it wasn't 25 years ago, there must be support online for that.
There's an interesting dichotomy, too, about the feelings of about transracial adoptions in the African-American community, African-American adults, and how they feel about white children or black children being placed with white families. Some of it spoken, some of it sort of understood. Where do you think that stands?
Well, I think that certainly with strangers, they are less likely to express their opinion to you as a stranger. But our experience was that, say, in the school system where our children's fellow students were mostly African American, the more a white parent of a child of color spends in the time they spend in the school, the more everybody gets to know you and eventually hopefully accept you. So you're not some weird, strange white person with a black child. And so for us, that seemed to be the key to just fitting in. It's just being involved in a school, in a social setting, in the neighborhood. And so people just knew who we were and accepted us.
And Yvonne Wenger, I mean, regardless of how people may feel about it one way or the other, and regardless of their color, as you mentioned, there are more than 100,000 kids, 120,000 kids waiting to be adopted. There's a paucity of foster parents and adoptive parents. And within that paucity of adoptive parents, the great minority of parents willing to adopt are African-American. There's just not very many African-Americans in the pool of potential parents.
Yeah, I hope that as our society evolves, that we can recognize that families should be connected based on love. And although there are some troubling signs that our country is not as progressive on race relations as maybe I once thought it was, it's a complicated thing. We've only just begun to understand how complicated it is.
Kathy on Facebook says, "You're both so very awesome. As a married woman hoping to adopt, I take a lot of hope from your stories. Thank you for sharing your experiences." Mike pings us on Facebook and says, "A few foster care workers from the Harford County Department of Social Services are listening to this interview and happy to be doing so." A listener says, "Great topic. I'm also a foster parent going through the adoption process through the Baltimore City Department of Social Services. There's a huge need for older children. My foster child is 14 and children who identify as LGBTQ. Their experience can be challenging, but so rewarding to see children with so much potential allowed to have resources and support, such as medical care, therapy, possible free college tuition, etc., to help them meet that potential." So there are some services that are particular to foster kids. I know there's a young man named Danny Jones who's involved with an organization called YANA, YANA, which in particular tries to connect homeless kids who are high school kids with resources that allow them to go to college. And he's talked to me a little bit about that efforts. He himself is a homeless kid. He was on the show a year or two ago. We got to know each other that way. So there are resources out there, but sometimes you got to dig a little bit for them. Let's go back to the phones to Martha in Pikesville. Welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah. Let me see. I'm supposed to turn the radio off now?
Yes, ma'am. That would help.
Okay. All right. So we adopted over 30 years ago. We were living in Baltimore City. And in Baltimore City, we were told because of our religion, forget about working with public auspices. And there were no suggestions made whatsoever about fostering or anything. Basically, forget it. We were lucky enough. We did finally adopt privately in Baltimore City, and we were lucky. The social workers had no problem whatsoever with religion or anything. It was the agencies themselves, with it publicly funded, for which I believe we actually pay taxes.
And so, Martha, let me ask you, what faith tradition were you raised in?
Tradition, we're both of the Jewish persuasion, as
okay.
they say.
So
yeah.
So because you were Jewish?
Because we were both Jewish.
Because you were Jewish, that was the reason they gave you for the Department of Social Services in Baltimore City not allowing you to adopt a kid? Wow. But 30 years later, of course, that's no longer the case. Thank you for that perspective, Martha. As a matter of fact, President Trump, just a couple of days ago at the National Prayer Breakfast, highlighted a family who had adopted five or six kids, but also pledged to tighten restrictions about agencies that receive public funding in terms of gay couples, same-sex couples adopting children, and tightening the ropes on religiously affiliated adoption agencies. That's certainly not good news to the folks who are in the system.
No, it's not at all.
Let's go back to the phones to Denise in Baltimore. Denise, thanks for calling Midday. Appreciate it.
Hi. Yeah, I just want to make sure that everyone knows about PACT Alliance. It's PACT Alliance, and it's out of Oakland. I adopted my daughter 22 years ago, And their specialty is transracial adoption. They not only help you through the adoption process, they stay with parents. They have summer camps. Historically, the summer camp has been on the West Coast, but they just opened one on the East Coast, where, because the children also have problems, especially when their parents are of a different race, that they won't talk to their parents for fear of hurting them. And so what PAC does is provide an atmosphere where these children can talk to each other and that the parents can also receive support. It's a wonderful organization, I'm glad that it has grown to the point that they can have a summer camp on the East Coast as well.
Well, that's great, Denise. Thank you so much for that call. The PACT Alliance, P-A-C-T Alliance. I mean, as you look forward, I mean, you know, little Adeline is 3 or 4 years away from kindergarten even. Mm-hmm. You know, what would you like to see, Yvonne, happen to society at writ large when it comes to acceptance, when it comes to, you know, her childhood school experience being a more positive one than perhaps it was for the kids that Martha and Pikesville tried to adopt 30 years ago?
I think it's on my husband and I to make sure that Adeline has everything that she needs. Growing up as an African American, eventually becoming an African American woman in this country. And there are some things that we want to do, like we've made the commitment, just like Joan and her husband, to live in Baltimore City, which of course is majority minority. White parents of black children are encouraged to attend church services where, you know, the congregation is majority black. We want to make sure that we do everything to support Adeline in becoming a black woman in America.
And Joan Jacobson, African-American parents talk all the time about having to have the talk, particularly with their African-American sons, and being a young black man in this city or any city in the United States. How did that talk come down with you and Bill, and have your kids experienced the kind of you know, problems that so many young black men are experiencing?
Well, we've been quite open about it, and Alex, as a black man with a driver's license, has been stopped driving while black, and it's pretty heart-stopping. One of the stories I tell in the op-ed in The Sun is the day two city police officers came to our door and said they were part of a team investigating stolen cars and asked if I had a car missing. And I said, no, why? And they said, well, we saw a young black man driving a car, and it's registered to, and I think they might have said older man, but didn't say white. But clearly they were driving around Northeast Baltimore looking for young black men driving cars to see if they were driving stolen cars. And I immediately said, my son is, at the time he might have been 22, he's African American. He's allowed to drive this car. And I think they were a little surprised, but they wouldn't said, okay. And they got on their radio and said, you know, false alarm or whatever. But, you know, if he were white, I don't think they would have flagged that car.
Indeed.
Just Joan driving down the street.
Joan Jacobson, she's a former reporter for the Baltimore Sun and the adoptive mother of two young African-American men, Willie and Alex. She wrote an op-ed in The Sun about her experience as a transracial parent, and we've got a link to that piece on our website. Yvonne Roenger is a current reporter for the Baltimore Sun. As well, she is a foster and adoptive parent. She described her experiences in a wonderful series in The Sun called The Wait. You can check out the Midday webpage at wypr.org/midday for a link to the article and the podcast. Yvonne, Joan, thank you both, and God bless you and the kids.
Thank you.
Thanks.
If you are interested in fostering and possibly adopting a child, you may want to start with these two sources, Adopt US Kids and The Heart Gallery. We've got links to those sites on our website. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, an immersive look into one of the Supreme Court's most notorious decisions, Plessy v. Ferguson, which in 1896 established the equal but separate standard for racial discrimination that wasn't repudiated by the court until 1954. Steve Luxenberg is the author of a terrific new book about the case. It's called Separate, The Story of Plessy v. Ferguson and America's Journey from Slavery to Segregation. We'll talk to Steve about it tomorrow. on Midday. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared has been recognized by the Daily Meal. Menus and hours can be found at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall. Here and Now is coming up after the news at the top of the hour. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.
This is 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station.